Welcome to It Could Happen Here, a podcast about things falling apart and sort of how you can put them back together. This is, again, another mostly things fall apart episode. Here with me is Garrison. Hello.
Hello.
And joining us today to talk about, well, a pretty wide range of things, but about the drug war in Mexico, about paramilitaries, and I guess about the narco state, is Alex Avina, who is an associate professor of history at Arizona State University and has written several very, very good articles that I've read recently. Alex, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for joining us. So I wanted to start by talking about an article that you has come out fairly recently that is about essentially the transition, particularly in Guerrero, from the sort of 60s, 70s dirty war in Mexico to the drug war. And I wanted to start from, because I don't think this is a history that's particularly well known. I want to start with sort of an overview of how we got into the sort of dirty war in Mexico in the 60s, because if people know stuff about this, it tends to be the very dramatic sort of like massacre in 1968, but it went on for longer than that and has a sort of deeper history. So can you bring us into that?
Yeah, for sure. I'll start off by saying that generally, when most people think about dirty wars and Cold War Latin America, Mexico is probably the last country that they think of having one, right? Like, there's a certain exceptionalism that Mexico has enjoyed until relatively recently, amongst academics and especially historians, right? Where we're in the last 10, 20 years, we started to uncover Mexico's own version of a dirty war that we are more familiar with in other places like Chile, Argentina, Brazil, Uruguay, et cetera. Mexico's dirty war, though, and if people know a little bit about this period, like as you mentioned, right, they know about the infamous student massacre at Tlatelolco on October 2nd, 1968. But, you know, my research focuses on the southern state of Guerrero. It's on the Pacific coast. It's made famous by the resort city of Acapulco. And I wrote a book published a book in 2014 that really traced the emergence of armed resistance in the state of Guerrero during the 1960s and 70s. And that was my entrance into this idea of a Mexican dirty war, of the Mexican state practicing systematic state terrorism against political dissidents, and in my case, armed guerrilla dissidents, who enjoyed the backing of dozens of rural communities and even urban poor working class neighborhoods in places like Acapulco in the late 60s and early 1970s. It's a very regional story, right? That's another thing that kind of distinguishes the Mexican Dirty War from other Latin American cases, is that the Dirty War was localized to a few major cities and then to very specific locales in the countryside, Guerrero being the most bloody theater. The way that these guerrilla movements emerged, they really began as these popular civic-minded social movements in the late 50s, early 1960s. And they protested things like political authoritarianism and economic injustice. But they did so essentially within the confines of the Mexican Constitution. They followed the law. Mexico has the characteristic in Latin America of having the first great social revolution of the 20th century. You do have a post-revolutionary government that emerges from the 1910 revolution that has to pay lip service to the radical traditions, to the revolutionary traditions that came out of that movement. And for that reason, the Mexican Constitution that was passed in 1917, in its time, was the most radical social democratic constitution in the Western Hemisphere. Peasant communities, campesino communities in the state of Guerrero believed the letter of the law. So when they started to protest, authoritarian state governors, police violence, army violence, economic injustice in the 60s, they followed the rules and they followed the laws. And each time that they did so, they experienced pretty horrific instances of both state violence exercised by the military and the police, but also everyday forms of violence practiced by, gunslingers who were working for landed elites. And that then radicalized some of these social movements into two separate guerrilla movements that were led by rural communist school teachers, Genaro Vázquez and Lucio Cabañas. And Lucio Cabañas' movement in particular, the Party of the Poor, they ended up creating a guerrilla force of about The high estimate is about 300 fighters. A more realistic estimate is somewhere from 150 to 200. But the key is that in coastal Guerrero and in some of the mountain communities of Guerrero, they obtain a pretty substantial amount of popular support, which then leads the Mexican government that had been, you know, ruled by the PRI, and Mexico was ruled by the PRI for like 80 years. They sent in the military and they waged this pretty horrific counterinsurgency that did things like disappear people, torture, rape. You know, they raised entire communities. And that's generally what's known as the dirty war in Mexico. It's rural theater. Its main rural theater was in a place like Guerrero, where we think there was almost 1,000 disappearances from 1969 up until the early 1980s.
Yeah, and one of the things that interested me a lot sort of reading through this was that it's sort of weird for an insurgency in that you get aspects of both kind of the kind of like classical 70s urban guerrilla movement, but it's also it's very much a rural movement. You have, you know, I mean, like one of the stories you tell in this is about, you know, like a group of people who did one of the, you know, like the classic urban 70s thing, which is that, you know, they did a bank robbery, and then two of the people get tortured and the rural guerrillas sort of get hunted down. And I was wondering about the dynamics of this, because it seems like you have these groups that are kind of unusually moving back and forward between like having bases in cities and having bases in these rural areas.
Yeah, that's usually when folks think about these guerrilla movements in Guerrero during the 60s and 70s, they think of them primarily as a you know, fairly typical rural guerrilla movement as you just described. But these two movements, the one led by Lucio Cabañas, the Party of the Poor, the other one by Genaro Vázquez, the ACNR, Asociación Cívica Nacional Revolucionaria, from the very onset, they tried to connect the rural to the city. Whether it was cities in Guerrero, like the resort city of Acapulco, particularly working class neighborhoods on the outside of the city, or the state capital in Chilpancingo, which housed the state university, right? So both of these movements made pretty substantial inroads into that community. And then also into Mexico City, right? So they tried. Their idea was not necessarily to start as a strictly rural movement, but their idea was always to expand, because I think to the cities. And I think quite rightly they perceived that what the Mexican state was going to do to them was try to corral them in the state of Guerrero and prevent them from logistically and politically expanding beyond that. And in the end, that's exactly what happened, and that's how these movements were ruthlessly crushed. That, and it took a lot of terror to separate these armed movements from their popular base of support. But a lot of this has to do with the fact that both Vázquez and Cabañas were school teachers, and they were involved in union movements that were national in scope. Lucio Cabañas was in the Mexican Communist Party, right? So he had extensive urban experiences and networks throughout the country. So their perspective was always to connect the rural to the urban, particularly because Mexico by the 70s was a rapidly urbanizing country, right? Yeah. It becomes for the first time in its history, well, first time in its post-colonial history, it becomes primarily an urban country. So they try these really interesting experiments to try to connect the two theaters. But as you mentioned, right, they did that typical 1970s thing of robbing banks, and their terminology was expropriation, right? But that then exposed them to police actions, and anytime any of their militants were captured, they were immediately tortured. Information, you know, that they were interrogated horrifically, and that intel was used to hunt down their comrades up in the mountains in Guerrero.
Yeah, and I think that's a good place to move towards sort of the other side of this, which is partially the Mexican state response, but the part of it that was really interesting to me was about how, you know, so part of what these groups are fighting are these sort of very, very local, like sort of landed elites. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how these sort of local elites are able to merge with and sort of like co-opt in a lot of ways the military units that are deployed.
Yeah, that's one of the biggest. So let me see how I can answer this question, because What I try to do in this article, and it's part of my broader ongoing research, is to kind of connect the violence, the state violence of the Mexican Dirty War as it happens in Guerrero in the 70s, with something else that's happening simultaneously, which is like the so-called drug war and the exponentially increasing cultivation of drugs in a place like Guerrero, particularly marijuana, and then opium poppies that are used to produce heroin. So what I try to do in the article that you're referencing is kind of to show there's a longer history in Guerrero of how power is exercised at the local level, and how some of these local landed elites are able to weather the 1910 Mexican Revolution. They're able to weather the agrarian reform efforts that occurred in the 1930s and 40s. And really these families, like one of the things that captures my attention of Guerrero is that you can tell who's in power by looking at their last name, because there's this remarkable continuity in the state of who has managed to exercise power at the local level, political, social, and economic power, for decades now, for generations. And you can track how power works by looking at families. And in what I do in this article is to look at a couple of landed elite families that had managed to stay in power for decades. So there's certain that landed in this article. I focus on one municipality called Coyuca de Catalan, which is in the hot lands region of Guerrero. During, probably from about 2008 to 2015, it was in the top three in Mexico for opium and heroin production. So it becomes this massive drug producing region. So I go back in time and I kind of trace like who was in power in this region, who owned land, who owned the resources throughout the 20th century, and how they were responsible for essentially creating this little narco fiefdom as it currently exists, and trying to figure out which families were involved. So on the one hand, you have these families that have been in power from like the 1920s and 30s, and they're still exercising power. And then when we get to the 1970s and you have this horrific dirty war, this counterinsurgency that the state and the military are waging against communities in Guerrero, that opens up new possibilities for new families to come in and to ally themselves with locally stationed military units. And they work together to wipe out guerrillas and guerrilla supporters. And at the same time, they start to, kind of dip their toe into this world of narcotics production. Because really, Mexico in the 1970s, especially by the mid-1970s, it becomes the number one provider of marijuana and heroin to the United States. And this is part of just a broader global history of narcotics, right? There's U.S.-led drug interdiction efforts in places like Turkey, Afghanistan, and in Southeast Asia. And efforts to suppress the drug production there creates this, what people usually refer to as a balloon effect. It just displaces the drug production somewhere else because the demand in the U.S. is still there. And that creates in Mexico the number one provider of narcotics by the mid-1970s. And that then has an impact locally in the place of Guerrero, which is, again, simultaneously experiencing a guerrilla insurgency, a dirty war, and then also the ramping up of drug production.
One of the most interesting parts of this that I didn't know about was about how, I mean, very, like how explicitly, because I've read a lot of, well, not a lot, but I've read about a lot of how, particularly like after, like when the sort of, after sort of the various upheavals in 2006 in Mexico with the Oaxaca uprising, with the Zapatistas making a bunch of moves, and the CP presidential election, about how you get the drug war as the sort of like military solution to these leftist movements. But I was interested in how, I mean, incredibly explicit they are about this. Like the anti-guerrilla operations are like, they don't call them anti-guerrilla operations. They talk about like bandits, and like they're explicitly like, no, this is an anti-narco operation, even though, they're going and massacring like essentially peasants and occasionally guerrillas, but just a bunch of just random like campesinos.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a great quote that I got from in this article. There's this wonderful researcher in Mexico, Carlos Flores, who has a really good book on kind of like the failed state in Mexico and drugs and military. And in that study, he managed to interview a military participant in the dirty war in the 1970s. And he has this great quote that I included in this essay, in which he says, this military guy says, basically, look, with the marijuana growers, we had no problem. We had no beef. But with the guerrillas, we had to fuck them up. And for me, like that direct quote kind of encapsulates like what the drug war in Mexico has been historically and in its current form. Like, and this is something that I learned from people like sociologist and journalist Don Paley, right? Like the war on drugs is a war on poor people. And it becomes in the 1970s, it becomes a really useful cover for the type of horrific violence that the state is practicing in a place like Guerrero against these popularly supported guerrilla insurgencies. So publicly and to the international audience and to its own domestic national audience, the Mexican state is saying, look, we're not waging a dirty war. We're not waging a counterinsurgency. We're fighting a war against cattle rustlers, against cattle thieves, and against criminals, against drug dealers. When in reality, they're waging a war against poor people who are supporting these different guerrilla insurgencies led by these rural communist school teachers. So that's in the rural theater, right? It's really interesting when you think about how the Mexican state in the 70s will criminalize urban guerrilla movements. You know, Mexico had like 38 guerrilla movements in the 1960s and 70s. That's just like people don't really recognize that, right? Like 38 to 40 different rural and urban guerrilla organizations. The big urban one that managed to create, I don't know, 10 to 12 different focos or foci, was the Liga Comunista 23 de Septiembre, the Communist League of the 23rd of September. They became such a big threat in the urban theater that the Mexican president, Luis Echeverria, devoted his 1974 State of the Union, basically the Mexican version of the State of the Union, he devoted a pretty good chunk of it to these quote-unquote terrorists, right? So for the urban guerrillas, he referred to them as terrorists. And then he does this thing where he says, you know, most of these terrorists are unpatriotic. And I'm going to paraphrase some of his language. They reveal high indices of homosexuality, of like just basically othering them to the point that they're seen as like the most despicable other in Mexico, in Mexican society. And that then opens them up to getting wiped out, which fulfills a similar function as calling the rural guerrillas nothing more than cattle rustlers, cattle thieves, and narcos, right? So it's all this counterinsurgency, like discursive strategy that justifies the elimination of these people. But at bottom, these are just wars against, the drug war is a war against poor people. And you see that to this day. You see that, you know, most, one of the things that really animates my research about the history of drug wars in Mexico is that I really want to push back against, you know, journalistic treatments that will say, look, Mexico's war on drugs began in 2006 when President Felipe Calderon, launched the military against these different drug trafficking organizations. And, you know, historians like myself who work on this were like, wait, no, Mexico's had a series of drug wars. Right. There's a historian, Alec Dawson, who has a really excellent book on peyote. And he talks about how the war on drugs begins in like the colonial era, right? In terms of how the Spanish colonial state criminalized indigenous consumption of drugs like peyote for their own ritualistic cultural practices. The 1970s is another moment where you have a form of drug war that the Mexican state exercises. But from my perspective, it's just it's almost like a cover as a way to wage war against political dissidents and armed guerrilla challenges to its rule in Mexico.
Yeah, and I think that's an important way of looking at it also as just a way to understand why, you know, like if you're looking at it from the perspective of like a policymaker, it's like, oh, well, we spent all this time doing the war on drugs. Like, why are there more drugs? And it's like, well, yeah, because I mean, the point isn't really about, like, I mean, I want to make a caveat here, which is like, it's not like there's such a thing as like a quote unquote good war on drugs that you could wage. Like there isn't a version of this that's like, oh no, if we actually just try to like focusing on stopping these people, it would work. But it's like, no, but simultaneously, yeah, it's that the goal isn't really about, like, it's not about drugs. It's just about killing poor people. And I think that's a good way of framing it. And I think also, it's an interesting way of looking at why you start to see these sort of supposedly like anti-narco units just immediately start doing, like, immediately get into the trade.
Because they're like, they're positioned to make a ton of money off of it. Yeah. Right? Like, it's, yeah, they're not dumb. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think, I don't know, there's an interesting question about, like, the structure of the state here, too, because, you know, like in Chicago, this is another, like, this is the thing that happens all the time, is, yeah, you get these anti-drug units that are, you know, incredibly specialized, they get a bunch of money, and then they immediately turn around and start into the drug trade. And so, I was just interested in this, of just about, there seems to be these very interesting sort of alliances between paramilitaries, cartels, the police, and the military that open up? And I this I know this is an incredibly broad, like, it's a question you can, like, you know, devote academic disciplines to, but I was wondering how you look at the state in the context in a context like this, because in a context where, you know, it's not, the state doesn't really have monopoly on violence.
Right. Yeah, no, that's a huge question. And there's how you, I mean, essentially the question is like, what is the state?
Which
is,
yeah,
like, that question always terrorizes me.
Yeah.
And how you answer that question then leads, has consequences to how we think about things like the drug war or, you know, violence in Mexico or a variety of different things, right? But so what I do in this article is on Coyuca de Catalan is to just simply look at what the state looks like at the local level, right? Mm-hmm. Particularly like its repressive apparatuses. And what you see in a place like Coyuca de Catalan, because you see kind of like it's a multi-scalar issue, right? Where you have generations of conflicts over land and land tenure and who gets to control rural markets, who gets to control access to rural markets and rural production, right? So there's already like a built-in structure that's exploitative that has somehow managed to weather a big social revolution and agrarian reform effort. And on top of that, then in the 60s and 70s, you get, industrialized narcotics production placed on top of this pre-existing structure, right? So it's should be no, it's almost like no surprise then that, you know, the gunslingers that used to work for landed elites will now serve as not just gunslingers for landed elites who are terrorizing campesinos, but now they're also going to work with like local narcotic, narco farmers, drug farmers, and traffickers. And then at the same time, they're going to do their best to co-opt, to buy off, you know, military units that are stationed at the local level, police units that are stationed at the local level, local judges, local magistrates, local political officials. And it creates a very dense network at the local level of people who are working together to maintain power, but at the same time, make sure that this really profitable political economy of narcotics is going to thrive. And this is at the very local level, right? So in some ways, those local interests of the quote unquote, the state will conflict with the state in Mexico City.
Yeah, yeah.
And how to resolve those tensions and becomes a big deal. So the military participant that I referenced earlier, he was actually sent in from outside of Guerrero into Guerrero to wage counterinsurgency. And, you know, he talks in this book about how they didn't know what to do when they see their soldier comrades, obviously collaborating with local narcos, even though although this guy and his unit have been sent in to wipe out the narcos. So what ends up happening is that the goal is never to eradicate the from a national level, from a state national level, the goal is never to eradicate the drug trade in Mexico in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. The goal is to rationalize it. The goal is to control it. And the goal is for the state to be able to maintain power over it. And this is it leads us to what, you know, some scholars will refer to as a plaza system, right? That different narcotic trafficking organizations will control different parts of Mexico, but the overall power, you know, they have to kick back to are different state officials. And that, you know, there's a recent really great book by Ben Smith called The Dope that just came out. It's really like the first really good English language, big history of the Mexican drug trade. And he essentially, he says that like the Mexican state is a racket. It's a racket, and it's ensuring that this drug trade exists and it's centralized and it's rationalized in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. But by the 90s, it starts to lose control as the state itself is neoliberalized and becomes smaller. And its capacity to control these different groups becomes weakened. So that's like the big national level, right? And then that takes us to the scale of the international, which is a whole other thing. But at the very local level, what does this look like? It looks like if you're a drug farmer, right? Because another thing in Guerrero is that these drug farmers are like small scale, right? They're small scale. They have a little bit of autonomy, but they're small scale. But they're selling their product to these traffickers. And these are the traffickers usually that will have connections to local landed families, who will have connections to military, to police, to politicians, that will ensure that this economy will continue to thrive in a profitable way. By the late 70s, and this is something else I think that I need to do a little bit more research on, but You see it happen elsewhere in Mexico, and especially in the Northwest, in a place like Sinaloa, which is usually seen as the cradle of the Mexican drug trade. But I think in the late 70s, both in Sinaloa and in Guerrero, the dirty war and the sending of the military en masse in a place like Guerrero, it not only takes out armed resistance of the Mexican state, but it will also take out small scale narco traffickers who don't want to play. They don't like the rules that the Mexican state is imposing upon them in order to make money and traffic drugs. So I've seen a couple of documents where, secret police spy agent documents where they say, okay, yes, you know, these campesinos who are accused of being guerrillas, yes, we are disappearing them, but apparently some small scale drug traffickers are also being disappeared because they don't want to go along with the rules being imposed by the Mexican military. And that's something that you see in Sinaloa in the late 70s when something called Operation Condor gets launched. And you get thousands of troops and federal police who go up there. And instead of eradicating the drug trade and getting rid of these different traffickers, what they do is they centralize it. They rationalize it. They make it more efficient. In a counterintuitive way, it's state violence that actually leads to the formation of things that we think about as cartels and not the other way around, right? Because the very trade begins within the confines of the Mexican state.
In part two of this interview, we're going to drill deeper into that question and look at how the state's attempt to get in on the drug trade created the cartels and how they sort of lost control of them, leading to an incredible increase in paramilitary violence and death and destruction. And on that happy note, this has been It Could Happen Here. Join us again tomorrow for that. And in the meantime, stay safe and don't die. If you want to find us, we're at Happen Here Pod on Twitter or Instagram. You can also find other work that we do at CoolZone Media on Twitter, if for some reason you want to continue venturing onto the hell sites. Goodbye.
It Could Happen Here is a production of CoolZone Media. For more podcasts from CoolZone Media, visit our website, coolzonemedia.com, or check us out on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can find sources for It Could Happen Here updated monthly at coolzonemedia.com/sources. Thanks for listening.